ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The Art Show. I'm Rosa Allen, and this week I'm continuing the series Dangerously Modern, a podcast made with the Art Gallery of South Australia.
They were described as dangerously modern, but the real risk these artists faced was being dangerously forgotten.
From Bendigo, Adelaide, and Sydney, to the salons and art scenes of London and Paris, we're telling you the stories of Australian artists who defied society's expectations and who were almost written out of history. Dangerously Modern is an exhibition, a book, and now a podcast, exploring how Australian women artists contributed to the development of international modernism, travelling long distances to Europe, working to support themselves, and forging friendships and networks along the way. When it comes to the artist Stella Bowen, a talent for living should be added to those pursuits. If you were a writer or an artist in Paris in 1924 and hung around with the likes of Ezra Pound or Gertrude Stein, you might have gone to a party hosted by Stella Bowen and her partner, the British writer Ford Madox Ford. Stella was much more than a bit player in bohemian circles, though. She was a practicing painter and an expert observer of everything around her.
She was known for being a very approachable person, someone that you could confide in, someone who was very measured, very grounded, discreet. And so, of course, that does translate into her depictions of people. My name is Tracy Locke, and I'm curator of Australian art at the Art Gallery of South Australia, and I'm also co-curator of Dangerously Modern, Australian Women Artists in Europe, 1890 to 1940. Stella was born in 1893 in North Adelaide, and she was born into a somewhat conservative middle-class family. Her father died when she was 3 years old. She talks about her mother being very pious, a kind of loving saint. So she recalls her mother really only ever wearing black. She really followed all of the maxims expected of a Victorian woman. There was a formality to her childhood. Really, essentially, the expectation was that she would marry well. Indeed, as a young woman, everywhere she went, she had to be chaperoned. So there was this sense of restrainment. Later in life, Stella recalled her city of Adelaide, where she grew up, was like a queer little backwater of intellectual timidity.
Intellectual timidity. A kind of hangover of Victorian provincialism, isolated by three immense oceans in a great desert, and stricken by recurrent waves of paralyzing heat. It lies shimmering on a plain encircled by soft blue hills, pretty-ish, banal, and filled to the brim with an anguish of boredom. I must be wrong. There must have been more to it than ever met my eye.
We have a rare insight into the life of Stella in her own words, thanks to her 1941 autobiography, Drawn from Life.
Stella was a vibrant, vital woman with a very sharp mind. She was curious and interested in life. And she got a kind of glimpse of an other horizon.
By then, there had settled in Adelaide a red-haired little firebrand of a woman who was not only an excellent painter fresh from Paris, but a most inspiring teacher. She was the only person in South Australia to employ a nude model.
Stella was, completely captivated by Margaret Preston, then known as Rose McPherson, and she did have to convince her mother to let her study with the artist. And Margaret was back fresh from that formative period in Europe with new ideas and a kind of creative charge. Stella later recalled walking up the stairs to Margaret's studio in Adelaide as the happiest moments of her life. Most importantly, I think Stella learned from Margaret that it was possible to be a professional artist, She seemed to have that same hunger to leave just as Margaret had. And Margaret seemed to recognise that determination in Stella very early on, even warning Stella's mother that her daughter was essentially destined for Europe, saying that you won't be able to keep her for long.
The opportunity to travel overseas came when her mother died. Stella was just shy of 21 and persuaded her guardians to let her go to England for just a year, and she would never return.
I'm Elle Freak, the Associate Curator of Australian Art at the Art Gallery of South Australia. I'm also the co-curator of the exhibition Dangerously Modern. So Stella Bowen leaves Adelaide in 1914. She leaves with a modest allowance from her uncle and from her mother's estate and a return ticket that, of course, she never uses. She did say in her autobiography that London wasn't what she had hoped it would be at first. I think those early years were a struggle.
For many women artists, arriving from distant Australia, it was hard to know where to go and who to study with. But eventually, Stella ended up enrolling at the Westminster School of Art in London, and she was under the tutelage of the British painter Walter Sickert. She was working in a sort of laboured tonalist manner where you would build up forms and create a three-dimensional sense. Walter Sickert had a different approach. He encouraged her to never touch the canvas twice in one place. But she ended up actually sort of hybridising different approaches to painting over time, really creating her own original way forward into painting. She was very tapped into almost like an underground society of progressives. She talks about at one point very early on when she was living in London, she was living with a young couple and they had some really interesting visitors. Some of the male visitors, she talks about them being extremely feminine, had their eyes mascaraed, and some of the female visitors being very masculine. The women were wearing pants and trousers, and she was quite shocked by that, but she also secretly loved it. She was a curious individual.
That curiosity saw her strike up friendships with outgoing creative people, like the drama student Phyllis Reed. Phyllis and Stella moved into a flat together, no small thing for two young women back then. They bought a gramophone, threw parties, drank beer, and amid the backdrop of the First World War, declared themselves pacifists.
Phyllis was heavily involved in poetry readings and performing. They found themselves very much immersed in the literary milieu of London. Before long, they found themselves at parties, and Ezra Pound, the writer, introduced them to a number of people. And it was at a party at Violet Hunt's house in London. She was a novelist and writer that Stella met Ford Madox Ford.
Ford Madox Ford is a prominent writer, critic, still serving in the army and also importantly married at the time.
I reacted violently against him at first on the grounds that he was a militarist. But I soon found out that if he was a militarist, he was at the same time the exact opposite. To me, he was quite simply the most enthralling person I had ever met. Worth all of Phyllis's young men put together, and he never even looked at her. He began to tell me about himself, filling me with pride by confiding all his troubles and weaknesses. The most monumental of authors, the fountain, apparently, of all wisdom, who appeared already to have lived a dozen lives, now amazingly announced that he wished to place his person, his fortune, his future in my hands.
So there was an age gap between them. Stella was in her 20s and Ford in his 40s, but they really seemed to bond immediately. They formed a complex but deeply meaningful relationship that lasted 9 years and resulted in their child, Julia. Their relationship really seemed to grow through their shared intellect. and a deep interest in art introduced Stella to many different artists and ideas, and meeting him really did seem to be a turning point for her personally and professionally. She was completely drawn into his world, which must have been so exhilarating, at least at first, but we know over time she found it quite difficult to find her own space within that world that was so shaped by his.
They struck up a correspondence, and certainly by 1919, they were living together in a little cottage in Sussex. In a very improvised environment, you know, no running water and no electricity, but they were happy as larks. Very shortly, their daughter arrives, Julia, who was born in 1920. So in a very short period of time, you find Stella, who had travelled across to London to study art and have a career as an artist. She's suddenly a young mother trapped in an environment that was really challenging. You know, financially it was very tough. By this stage too, Ford had started to write again. Stella saw herself as very important in that return to, she believed in his abilities and his talent, and she wanted to see him thrive as a writer. And so she found herself as really a servant to that achievement. And so she started to sacrifice her own creative pursuits to ensure that, you know, meals are prepared and the cleaning's done and the household is running and the household is kept very, very quiet, all at the same time having a very young baby.
Even when working at my easel, my head was conscious of Ford's needs and wishes and states of mind. This would have not been so if I had been bored by him, but I was not. Nobody could be. I don't think it ever occurred to Ford that if I had been a 100% professional artist like himself, I should have been very little use to him.
With baby in tow, wintertime in their 300-year-old cottage was even harder. So Stella and Ford decided to warm up in the French countryside. They employed a nanny, and Stella began to paint again, sending work to Paris to be exhibited. And in a sisterly side note, another expat Paris-based artist, Ethel Carrick, also in the Dangerously Modern exhibition, submitted Stella's paintings to the Salon d'Automne. Within time, Stella and Ford found an apartment to live in Paris, and Stella was at peace there for the time being. The avant-garde poet Edith Sitwell was just one of Stella's painting subjects. She was drawn to compelling people, whoever they were, and enjoyed bringing them together.
Of course, their artistic and literary circles included a number of fauvists and vortices or cubists and so forth. And of course, she was familiar with the work of Pablo Picasso, seeing his work in Gertrude Stein's home. And her work was focused on figurative realism. So she was conscious that her work looked conservative, but she had this wonderful rapport with Ford insofar as he encouraged her to paint in that manner because he believed, as did Stella, that there was a power to linear form and a power to colour, and there is an aesthetic way to paint emotion with great impact. Certainly her image of Ford Madox Ford playing solitaire, and what I particularly love about that work is she captures this idea of both stillness and movement, suggesting that he's playing this round of solitaire, a card game, but at the same time he's got these piercing blue eyes that look directly at the viewer. You get the sense that his mind is absolutely whirring away, flying away at a very fast rate. He would play while he was writing and forming sentences. He would form them in his mind while he was playing the card game. For me, it's a very cerebral image. And of course, he's got a dropped lower lip, which is not very attractive, but it was an old war wound from when he served in the First World War. And he's a rather kind of chunky, solid fella. And some people question, you know, what on earth did she see in him? But I believe that they had a really intense connection. Of course, at the time that Stella met Ford, he was married. And Ford had many relationships throughout his life. It's recorded that he had about 18 different relationships, and about 11 of those were sexual. In comes to the scene, Stella steps in, and of course she remains with him for 9 years, and that wasn't easy for her because, of course, she had to really come to terms with his infidelity, which became in the end, after an issue in around 1924, there was another individual on the scene and the relationship was getting very crowded, but certainly by the end, towards the end of 1927, they decided to part their ways.
Falling out of love is a delicate and important business, and as necessary to the attainment of wisdom as the reverse experience.
We're looking at Stella's self-portrait of circa 1928, and when I look at this portrait, I can't help but feel I'm looking at someone who has gone through some kind of trauma. I feel like she presents to us as though she's wearing a mask. There's a great intensity to her gaze, and it's as though she's reaching out to us to say, I'm okay, I'm all right. She appears to be well-groomed. Her hair is beautifully brushed, and she's wearing earrings and a brooch. But I sense there's something rumbling, and there's like an earthquake going on behind. The collars of the white shirt and the red jacket, they're slightly out of order, and it makes me feel that there are sort of the shock waves of what's going on behind her. I find it a completely galvanizing image, and I think it's one of her most important works of this period of the late 1920s.
Stella's presence was mostly by way of the really wonderful self-portrait of hers that hung on my grandmother's dining room wall. So she was a breakfast companion when I would stay at my grandmother's overnight, eating my breakfast of liver and kidneys and brains. My name is Rob Brookman, and I'm Stella Bowen's grandnephew. Stella cared about her nieces and nephew. She, in fact, would send presents and at one point built this rather gorgeous toy theatre, which she then painted by hand, all made out of cardboard, and then had it shipped over to Adelaide as a present for my mother. That little theatre stayed in our family. I used to play with it when I was a kid, and it's now a proud possession of my oldest son. So there was a real connection to this distant aunt who my mother had never known in person. Mum was interested in anything that she could find out about Stella, but was also particularly interested in where all the work had gone because Stella was prolific.
Stella describes her breakup with Ford as a true rebirth. She found it energizing, the feeling of finally being a queen in your own right, as she put it. We can see that new sense of freedom and clarity in her approach to painting. She commits entirely from this point onwards to her own powerful form of realism. And she created one of the works that's really captured my attention in Dangerously Modern, a watercolour titled Interior Portrait of 1931. So in this work, Stella really transforms an otherwise modestly furnished corner of her bedroom into a deeply psychological space. She presents us with two chairs, and they're illuminated by the diffused light of a window. We see a curtain gathered to the side, but there's no human figure, her decision just to really focus on that window, I think, is really significant. And she even notes in her autobiography how her interiors at this time kind of seem to always turn out to be pictures of windows, and how Freud may have seen some kind of peculiar significance in this.
By 1933, Stella realised she couldn't continue to pay the rent on the apartment at Rue Bossonnard in Paris, and she had to leave France. And it was a very big wrench for her. Ultimately, she ended up living in a little cottage called Green End in rural England. By this time, the war was beginning. At Green End, she spent her time writing her autobiography, which she also thought would amend and help her financial situation. But the book sold out and it couldn't be reprinted because of restrictions at wartime.
When the Art Gallery of South Australia contacted Stella in around 1943, having read her autobiography, it was this work, Embankment Gardens, that she offered the gallery for acquisition. It would become the only painting acquired for an Australian gallery during her lifetime. It was also not long after that acquisition that, with the Art Gallery of South Australia's recommendation, Stella was appointed an official war artist, and that appointment gave her a renewed sense of purpose as an artist and really marked a significant moment of recognition for her quite late in life.
Stella was one of the few women artists to be appointed an official Australian war artist. She holds this distinction with Nora Hyson, whose work is also included in Dangerously Modern.
Stella was gaining momentum with her work during the war, and she was also feeling quite nostalgic about her home in Australia, and she was planning to stage an exhibition of her work in Adelaide, in her hometown. And she was very excited about that and had her family arranging venues and working on her behalf back in Adelaide. But unfortunately, she was unable to ever return to Adelaide because she ended up dying of cancer at the age of 54 in 1947. So in a sense, her life and her career was very much cut short, prematurely cut short and unfairly.
I wish I'd known her, because I feel like she had many of the generous qualities that I think came down from that side of the family. My mother also had them, just this equanimity and ability to take people as they came. Stella often would describe herself in the memoir as, you know, being a bit of a kind of country mouse, living in this extraordinary demimonde that she ran into, where, you know, suddenly she's going to parties with the great poets and artists of the time. And yet, you know, her head stays firmly screwed on. I just wish that she had lived into her 60s and 70s and been able to return to Adelaide as she very much wanted to, in which case I would have been the lucky and adoring great-nephew.
Of course, in some ways, her career and her visibility really lost momentum. In 1953, there was an exhibition of her war work, and which was very, very successful. But again, you get this very long silence. It took really until the year 2002 for a retrospective to be staged that really brought her back to people's attention and was a way of promoting her achievements and to show what a fine artist she really was.
After a season at the Art Gallery of South Australia, Dangerously Modern, the exhibition, is now on at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and you can see the paintings by Stella Bowen that we've been talking about on display there, as well as those from the artist featured in our next episode, Dorrit Black.
That painting, you know, is iconic in the true sense of the word.
more and more as she progressed in the medium, it was a source of conveying the kind of inner vital force of nature.
Dorrit is the unmarried daughter. She basically says, so do you want me, after all my efforts here in Sydney, you want me to just give it all up?
In this episode, you heard from two of the dangerously modern curators, Tracy Locke and Elle Freak, as well as Rob Brookman.
This series is produced by me, Rosa Allen, with sound engineering by Melissa May and original music from Margie Jean Lewis. Dangerously Modern was recorded on Kaurna and Wurundjeri lands. This is The Art Show. You're on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.